Hi, welcome to Books and Arts this Saturday afternoon. I'm Sarah Kanoski, bringing you the best of the past week on the show. Today you'll meet Jeffrey Drake Brockman. He's an artist who combines robotics and visual art to create solar-powered ballerinas, blooming origami flowers, and giant people counters, among other things.
I do enjoy the idea of gothic horror, you know, those wonderful stories of Frankenstein and Dracula, and they inhabit my work at some level, even though everything is displayed in candy colours.
And the fabulous children's author Mo Willems, author of Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus and other classics, all of which are informed by Mo's keen sense of the differences between kids and adults.
They're not stupider, they're just new. Everything is new. Everything you have to learn. Can you imagine waking up every morning and going, oh man, I'm going to have to learn 40 new things today.
First on Books and Arts this Saturday afternoon, a play about love set in war-torn Palestine. The Palestinian territory of Gaza is a place we usually hear about when there's been more fighting between the Israelis and Palestinians or another failed peace accord. But in Tales of a City by the Sea, playwright Sama Sabawi looks at the way people try to live full lives in Gaza despite the terrible circumstances. Michael Cathcart speaks with Sama and actors Helena Sawires and Osama Sami.
So Sama, this is a love story. Very briefly tell us who's in love, where are they?
Well, there's a few different love stories in this love story. There's the main love story, which is between the character Osama plays, Rami, and Jumana, the character that Helena plays. And Rami comes from the US. He's born and raised in the US. He's a diaspora Palestinian who, according to Jumana, wears his Palestinian identity as if it were a fashion statement. but he falls in love with Jumana, but he doesn't fall in love with Gaza completely.
He arrives in Gaza and falls in love with a local girl.
And they've been chatting on Skype and blogging prior to his arrival. But he has all these romantic notions about what it means to be Palestinian, and he goes there. And then a year after he spends a year in Gaza with her, he makes the realization that maybe this is not the place for him to stay and to raise his kids. And so his American identity kind of kicks in. And the battle begins between do we stay or do we leave. Now, Jumana doesn't want to leave because she knows that if she leaves, she'll never see her family again because Gaza's under siege and you can't get in and out easily. So that's the dilemma of their story. But there are other love stories in the play as well. It's really a celebration of people's abilities to love and to have normalcy in the most abnormal and insane circumstances.
And Sama, how do you come to be telling this story? Do you have links with Gaza yourself?
Yes, I do. And a lot of these stories are actually real stories that have happened to people that I know or to family members. And the Skype scenes are a bit too close to my heart because there was a long period of time where my husband was actually in Gaza and I was here in Australia. And that was the time I started writing the play and we were Skyping as a means to communicate. We were surrounded by these stories and I just felt that it was important for these stories to be told because there are lessons for us to learn from such stories and a lot of inspiration to be had.
So, Helena, you play Jumana. This is the girl that this chap falls in love with, this American. Who is she?
She is, she's the staple in the play, and she has relationships with everyone that is involved with it. She's a very strong woman. She's very independent. She's very feisty.
So what you're telling is that you're an actor who believes the play is all about herself.
No.
It's all about me. That's what you're saying. You're an actor. I understand this.
No. She's what
she
I'm saying.
Feisty.
She's like, she's very feisty. But I guess in a way she sort of strings along the play, bringing in all these different characters and revealing these relationships and revealing the struggles of particularly the Palestinians and what they go through.
And what do you see in this doctor who's shown up?
I see a lot in him. He's got a lot of character, but it's very hard for me because I'm not Jomana doesn't give her heart away easily at all. And particularly to a foreigner, it's very hard for her.
Oh, you think of him as a foreigner?
Well, he is a foreigner, yes. But I think he definitely belongs in Palestine. He belongs in Gaza because it needs him. And
why does it need him?
Because he is there to help us throughout the siege and to help protect us from the Israelis.
He's a doctor.
We've not said this yet.
Yeah. He's a doctor, and he in the time that he is there, he does help out with, you know, in the hospitals.
Right.
But I think also for him, it's just too much. And like Samah was saying, the American side of him does kick in, and it's too overwhelming because these are two completely different, contrasting worlds.
Let's find out what he says himself. So, Sami, you played this doctor.
Yeah.
So he's a man caught between two worlds? Is that how you see him?
Absolutely, yeah. It's the identity, which the sense of belonging that we all experience at some stage or another, particularly if you have a different background to the place that you're born in.
So this idea that you wear your Palestinian identity like a fashion statement, do you have a kind of romantic view of what it means to be a Palestinian, at least when you're back in America?
Absolutely. It's, because once they break through the siege with the Italians and the others, the Vittorio character, the thought is that it's all dancing and balloons and they have the debka and they've got food and it's wonderful. It's romanticized. It's a fantasy, those 6 days where they break the siege, because after that, after a couple of months, that's when the war
arrives into Gaza.
Yes, just remind us about the siege, Sama.
Yeah, so
what actually happened historically?
Historically, Gaza has been under siege and under occupation since 1967, under Israeli occupation. And since 2006, the siege has been tightened as a result of the Hamas winning the elections. And so there is this tightened siege on Gaza. In 2008, an international fleet of boats, flotillas, head towards Gaza to challenge the siege, because by that year, the siege has had a horrible impact on the population, with children not receiving enough nutrition, food not getting in. You know, it's a political mess, and it's a horrible mess for the people who live in Gaza.
So
he arrives, yeah, as a doctor on one of the boats that were bringing in medical stuff.
Oh,
and
I see.
And so on, and challenges the siege. And historically speaking, there were boats that made it in 2008 in August. And broke the siege for the first time.
And Rami arrives early, before the war breaks out. So then there is this idea that this is actually quite okay. I mean, one could live here. And then when the war breaks out and he finds the second time he comes back in, he can't get in because Israel and the Egyptians have shut the borders and he has to go in through the tunnels illegally. That's when he realizes, no, this is completely different.
This is the classic structure for a really marvelous play, when you've got very intense personal relationships set against a broad social canvas. If you can get those two elements working, you've really pulled it off. Now, you're going to do a scene for us. Do we need to know any more about this scene? Just set it up for us.
Yeah, so in this scene, the Rami has been in Gaza for a whole year.
Yeah.
And it's one of the scenes towards the end of the play. And
but it's not the ending.
It's not the ending. No, it's not. Yet. And we don't give away the ending.
But it's the moment where he realizes, actually, I don't know if I can do this.
Uh-huh.
And you see my reaction. And yeah, you know, we can get arrested for this.
Arrested for kissing? This place keeps growing on me every day.
What was that?
I'm just so sick of this. The waiting. Remind me again why we're not married yet.
Because you still need to go back to Texas and close your clinic and move your things.
No, I mean, why are we waiting? Let's just have the wedding here, and then you can come and live with me in Texas. It's a great place. You'd love it there. And you know, kissing's actually celebrated in that part of the world, not criminalized.
Oh, well then let's go.
No, I'm serious, Jomana. I want us to get married and leave, both of us together.
Leave? We've talked about this. You promised me you would stay here. I can't leave. If I leave, I may never see my family again.
Well, what about my mom and her right to hold and embrace her grandchildren? What about our own children? Don't they have the right to the best education, the best environment, the best life?
What exactly is this about? You promised me you would stay here. I thought we had a plan.
But plans don't work in this environment of uncertainty.
I never would have allowed myself to get so close to you if I knew you planned to uproot me. You promised.
I did, but that was before I knew what it was like to live here. Now I know.
Now you know? Oh, they tried to warn me, but I didn't want to listen. My father told me your roots were not dug deep
Stop,
in the soil.
Jemana,
I told him
please,
I had faith in you.
I need you,
you
to hear me out, please. You know I love you. I'd go to the moon and back for you. But what we're talking about here is marriage and raising a family. This complicates things a lot. You know, since the day I've come here, I've treated hundreds of children with bullet wounds, shrapnel, white phosphorus burns, explosives, and I kept wondering to myself, what if my own child's brought to me on a stretcher? How do I protect my own children from this sky that rains death at will? What if the woman that I love
Please don't,
is
don't. What if? Rami, my life is here. My family is here. I was raised here. This place is my home.
No, this place is a prison. You're trapped behind a big wall and you just can't see it. Do you really want to condemn our children to this fate?
Yes, we are trapped behind a wall. But Rami, look around you. Yeah? Open your eyes. See the stories of how we survive. The trees we've replanted, the homes we've rebuilt. Inside these walls, Rami, old men still fiddle with their prayer beads. Mothers still bake mamul on Eid. Families still gather under canopies with loaded bunches of grapes dangling above their heads. They nibble on watermelon seeds and drink meramia tea. Women still perfect the art of matchmaking. Men still dream of freedom and democracy. Children climb on the almond trees. Lovers woo in secrecy. And no matter how the conditions are adverse, over here we have learned to defy the universe. Every day inside these walls, Rami, we defy the universe.
I don't know how you all do this. I'm not from here. I'm not used to this.
Look, I know it's not easy for you. You have a life out there that I can't even imagine. But my life is right here.
This has been a very difficult year.
I know. Rami, we've been through hell this year. I know that neither of us are the same person that we were that day on the beach a year ago. I'm not the same woman that begged you to stay. I really do understand, Habibi. So if you have doubts...
No, I don't doubt my love for you.
If you have doubts, Rami, you're free to leave.
I can't live without you, Jemana. I can't live without you.
So what now?
Gosh, that's a powerful piece. Helena Sawiris and Osama Sama with that scene from Tales of a City by the Sea. Now, Sama Sabawi, you wrote this play. Has it been performed in Gaza?
We had a public reading in Gaza for the play in 2013, and that went really well. And then we planned to have it open in Gaza, in Melbourne and in the West Bank on the same day. As a way of saying we're all connected,
yeah.
You know, the diaspora community is connected. Unfortunately, 2 months before the play went into production, and as we were just starting actually the casting call in Gaza, the 2014 war broke out, and 51 days later, the Gaza city was totally devastated. Two-thirds of the city was turned to rubble, and many of the members of our production over in Gaza lost loved ones and close family members and neighbors, and so they were in no condition to do the production, and you know, they're still not that much better off today, unfortunately.
So that was when the play premiered here in Australia in 2014.
That's right.
And now you're back. Helena, did you know much about Gaza before you took on this role?
I didn't, to be honest. I'm quite naive when it comes to political stuff, but it's been really great because Wahibi, the director, she's been encouraging a lot of research and you know, things pop up every day in rehearsal. You know, it's important to do that.
So there's a fair bit of diversity within the cast, isn't there?
Yes, we have, and it's beautiful diversity. Actually, I was reflecting on the fact the other day that I didn't even know that Osama was Shia. That's I'm Sunni, and so according to what you hear on the news, we're supposed to be killing each other. But the cast has a beautiful, diverse group of people, and in the production as well, we've got people of the Jewish faith, people of the Christian faith, people who are atheists, people who are Muslims, and so it goes. So we're very proud
we're
of that.
We're all supposed to kill each other. We're just waiting for the yeah, right time we're just to waiting. Move in. That's the whole...
The cast party's really going to go
it's
off.
Gonna, that's right, the final, the last day. The bump out's going to be yeah, very, very
it's
interesting.
Be great.
Oh, lordy, lordy, lordy. And Asami, you say on your CV that you're a failed cricketer and a struggling Muslim.
Yes.
So you sound a bit divided yourself, are you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the... it's because, you know, I came to Australia as a teenager from the war-torn Iran, Iraq. And so I've, it's always been a struggle. Am I an Aussie? Am I still, you know, and then it seems, you know, when you read in the papers that you almost can't be an Australian if you're a Muslim, or if you're a Muslim, you can't be an Australian. So it is that identity struggle
every day. Yeah, well, we all just have to defy that. Don't
absolutely.
We? Because one thing about Australia is it's a land of becoming. Mm-hmm. You know, there are lots of countries and not places of becoming. You know, you can't become Japanese, for example, I don't think. No, I'm sure you can't. But you can become Australian.
Absolutely.
And that is where the hope lies, surely. Yeah.
Absolutely. It is the true land of the dreams. You can make dreams come true.
Dream.
No, absolutely.
And we're in Melbourne where the Lord Mayor of Melbourne just recently said that the idea of building a mosque
was so welcome
in central Melbourne was a great thing. It was mm-hmm. what Melbourne was all about.
Yeah, after mm-hmm. what happened in Narre Warren. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. This is very, it was very heartwarming.
Yeah. It gives you hope, doesn't it?
Michael Cathcart speaking with the playwright Sama Sabawi and actors Helena Sawiris and Osama Sami. Tales from a City by the Sea is on at La Mama in Melbourne until the 29th of May, and it's then touring. We've got all the details at the Books and Arts website at RN. There's a disobedient bus-driving pigeon, a toddler who loses her beloved toy Nuffle Bunny, and an optimistic piggy who is best friends with a somewhat dour elephant. These are some of the wonderfully memorable creations of American author and illustrator Mo Willems. Mo started out as a writer and animator with Sesame Street, and then when he turned his hand to picture books, his very first won him the prestigious Caldecott Medal, and that book was the now infamous Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus. A new exhibition of Mo's work is on show now in New York. It's called The Art and Whimsy of Mo Willems. And Mo joins me from Massachusetts to talk about it. Welcome to Books and Arts, Mo.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Mo, we should say congratulations because this is the very day that the last of your Elephant and Piggy series has been published in the States. How does that feel?
It's pretty exciting. It's been great. It's a book called The Thank You Book. I'm really wanted to end the Elephant and Piggy series by being on the nose and thanking my audience, thanking my readers. And it's been wonderful. It's been a great experience. I wrote thank you letters to a librarian or teacher in every state of the union that an organization I work with called First Book found for me, people who are, you know, not thanked enough.
That's fantastic. You sent out personally thank you letters.
Yeah.
And I've been
thanking all the people who helped me in my early career and all the people who helped me with Elephant and Piggy. And it's been very exciting. And now I'm really ready to start something new and get terrified again.
Well, I mean, Elephant and Piggy is a series, if people don't know it, featuring these two kind of Laurel and Hardy figures and these are books, Mo, that are meant for kids who are just starting to read. So they work
Yes, well, actually, they're books that are meant for people who haven't learned how to be embarrassed yet. So they're for everyone, but they are specifically written with being an easy reader in mind. So I have a very controlled vocabulary. I like to say that easy readers are also known as hard writers.
So do you start with more language that you then pare back? What's the process for creating the language in an Elephant and Piggy book?
You know, that's interesting. Sometimes I do that. I've got a list of words, and we do run it by someone who's smart who will vet it. But really what I'm looking for is a philosophical question I don't know the answer to, because you're starting to read at age 5 or 6, and that really is the most philosophical time. That's when you're asking the deep Greek questions. You know, why is there pain? Why are people mean to me? Can I drive a bus? Those sort of things.
The big issues in life. Well, with the Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus or the Pigeon series, the reader is in a slightly different position than perhaps Elephant and Piggy, but they're still really involved in the narrative. They're stories where, you know, when I've read them out loud to my kids, the kids are yelling back at the book. There's yes. a lot. There's a lot of kind of the fourth wall is broken down with your pigeon books, Mo.
It's the fourth wall is decimated. It is set on fire. It is stomped out. I try to put in 49% of the content, and I want my audience to put in 51. You know, the excitement of this is, I don't just want my books to be read, I want them to be played. So you read them a couple times, but then you want to go out and you want to create your own books. You want to be able to take my characters and put them through the paces. And particularly with the pigeon books, there's nothing more rock and roll than yelling no at the top of your lungs in a library. I mean, and it's pretty boss.
And the great pleasure of, I think, for kids and for adult readers too, of the pigeon. The pigeon is doing what we all want to do. It's just like unrestrained id. The pigeon wants to eat hot dogs. It wants to drive a bus. It wants a puppy. It wants cookies. And it's yes. like you get to play being, the kids get to play being the authoritative, the sort of super ego, which puts a restraint on all those fantastic, you know, insatiable desires that the pigeon has.
Right. So you can see I'm difficult to live with.
Your family having to constantly yell no. Don't yes. let Mo. Don't let Mo drive the bus.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because I wondered, Mo, if you were writing for adult readers as well. I mean, how do they figure that the adults, the teachers, the parents, the librarians who are going to be reading these stories with kids?
Well, I'm writing, you know, I'm writing music. And when I'm writing a picture book, which is not an early reader, that is something that the kid, you know, you remember, I write for illiterates. So, which is a weird thing to do. But so I'm dependent on my orchestra. And so I want to make sure that my orchestra is jazzed. I want to make sure that my orchestra really wants to play this piece. Because if you go to a symphony and they're like, I'm just playing this thing I don't feel like playing. Or if it's some really great Brahms or something and everyone's excited, it's better. So I have to be conscious that my orchestra has to be excited. And in that way, my audience is going to get excited.
And I think that one of the ways that you excite your orchestra is the incredibly expressive line that you have for your faces, your figures, even if they're quite simple. I think about the father figure who reappears in the Nuffle Bunny series, where Trixie goes through a series of disasters with her beloved necessary toy, Nuffle Bunny. And there are moments where the father realizes in each book that Nuffle Bunny has disappeared, and the sense of profound existential despair that you convey through that father with his head in his hand, I think, is something every parent can relate to.
It's all about the existential despair. It's all about the existential despair. Absolutely.
And I mean, you're a writer who gives that pleasure to readers, you know, young and old, whether they're the singers or the orchestra, of cameos. Your pigeon will reappear across your story. So it's a bit like a Hitchcock
yes.
film where the pigeon's suddenly there.
He hates it when I make books that are not about him. He despises it. He has an ego. He can't understand why I would spend time with not him. So every night in the middle of the night, when he'll sneak into one of my books and hide in there.
This is Books and Arts on ABCRN. I'm Sarah Kanoski, and I'm speaking with the wonderful children's illustrator and author Mo Willems. And his work is the subject of a new exhibition on at the New York Historical Society. And joining me now is Rebecca Klassen, who is Assistant Curator of Material Culture at the New York Historical Society. Welcome, Rebecca, to Books and Arts.
Thank you.
So if we talk a little bit more now about this exhibition, Rebecca, walk me through it. What do I see? Mo's been talking about the Elephant and Piggy. He's been talking about the pigeon, and of course there's Nuffle Bunny. Are all those works on show in the New York Historical Society?
You see all the above. You see preliminary sketches, final illustrations, published illustrations, and you understand more what goes into all of those illustrations. And then also you see preparatory works, character sketches. Mo spends a lot of time developing his characters.
And what do we learn about Moe's process, do you think, Rebecca? Does he start with words? Does he start with pictures? What can you reveal about the way that Moe works? And then Moe can tell us if that if that analysis is correct.
Well, he probably starts with pictures, imagery, gets ideas for instance, the pigeon was inspired by an actual pigeon that Moe encountered in Oxford, England.
Is that pigeon getting royalties, Moe?
12,000 progeny are all doing very, very well.
And is that true, Moe, that you'll start with the drawing? Is that where you're...
No, actually, I see the type as a type of drawing, and I see drawings as a type of writing. Sometimes I ask this question. When you're walking, do you use your eyes or your legs? Now, obviously, there are people who can walk and they're not ambulatory, or the blind people can walk. But generally, I think it's accepted that you do both in combination. And so a drawing will spark a word, which will spark a new drawing. I don't see any of those things as being different. And that's why I define myself as a cartoonist, because I think when you say cartoonist, people sort of see that those things work in tandem.
Mm. And another feature of your work, Moe, is even in really simple stories, there's a real pacing and a real narrative arc. You started off working in TV, nine seasons, right. I think, with Sesame Street. Is that partly disappointing? That you learnt in television?
Yes, I think that, and I worked in cable television and animated series for a long time, and in cable television, the rule is you have to be funny by Tuesday. That's just the way it is. And so what happens is, over time, you develop muscles. I don't think you can ever know what is funny, but you can get the muscles that you know what isn't funny. And so you just take out the not funny. And whatever's left, you have to hope for the best.
Rebecca, why did the New York Historical Society, which sounds quite a sort of a regal institution, why did it want to feature the work of Moe Willems?
Well, Moe is absolutely relevant to kids today, and we wanted to be able to engage with today's audiences, really, and also multi-generational families. So we opened it with Moe's early work, his education in New York, at NYU Tisch School of the Arts, and his work at Sesame Street, and his student film. So that giving that foreground, and then we also included a comic short story called Walking the Williamsburg Bridge to Work, where Moe discusses his experience of 9/11 and witnessing the tragedy unfold around him as he's on his daily commute, and using that as a bridge to understanding the Knuffle Bunny series, which features the family that appears in that short story.
What do you want to say about that work, Moe? Because it sounds like that's intended for adults, that piece.
It was after 9/11, DC Comics asked a bunch of comic artists, cartoonists, and comic book artists to write about their experiences. And my experience was, in fact, very visceral. And I pretty much laid it out as it happened. And it sort of became the first fictionalized version of my family. I'm very glad that that is in the exhibit, because it obviously is a story that matters to me, and it changed my relationship with New York quite a bit. A matter of fact, I think it made me stay there. I was there for 22 years. I think it made me stay there longer. I felt very, very connected to the city and the population of the city. I think a lot of people started talking to each other in ways that they didn't before this horrific thing happened. So it was very important to me.
I just wanted to sort of finish up by asking, the way you're describing your characters, and anyone who's picked up a Moe Willems books knows they're incredibly entertaining and they're expressive, and there's so much unrestrained emotion. I think that's just a great gift of these books. But there's also an emphasis on manners, on pleases, on thank yous, and that's certainly the case with this latest Elephant and Piggy book. How do you sort of chart your way as a children's writer in terms of your responsibility to your readership?
Do
you think
really
of that?
Interesting. I don't think of myself as being polite at all. Not at all. No, I really am asking questions, and I'm asking questions that I don't know. I think This last book, the thank you book, comes from a place of gratitude, obviously, but it also is about going back and revisiting some of the characters that Elephant and Piggy had met before. Elephant Gerald is paranoid that Piggy is going to mess up this thanking, that she's going to forget someone, that it's going to be a thanking disaster. That's the fear. The fear is that even when you do something that you should, you're going to do it terribly and you're going to ruin it in some inexplicable way. And that's because that's what we do every day. We're constantly tripping and failing and spitting and farting and dropping and all that kind of stuff. That to me is what it's about.
So it sounds though like that you're keying into kids' anxieties around how to behave rather than giving them a model of how to behave.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're new. The difference between kids and adults, they're not stupider. They're just new. They're new. It's horrible being new. Everything is new. Everything you have to learn. Can you imagine waking up every morning and going, oh, man, I'm going to have to learn 40 new things today. You know, if I learn one new thing in a week, I take a nap. It's exhausting. You know, I'm not trying to mold them into obedient little whatever you want. I want them to be people.
So you tell me kids are not going to be nicer or kinder or better kids after reading a Mo Willems book.
I hope that they'll be more empathetic. I hope that when they're laughing at the characters, they'll see that some of themselves or someone they know in that, and that they will have sympathy for them. What I love about the pigeon is that kids can yell no to the pigeon. They can deny the pigeon. They can be screaming at the top of their heads, and then they still love the pigeon. That's great.
Well, let's hope for that. A great dose of empathy after reading Mo Willems and, of course, visiting the exhibition at the New York Historical Society. Mo and Rebecca, thanks so much for coming on to Books and Arts.
Thank you.
Thanks. It was really fun.
Mo Willems is an award-winning author, animator and illustrator. And Rebecca Klassen is the Assistant Curator of Material Culture and she's Exhibition Coordinator at the New York Historical Society, where the show The Art and Whimsy of Mo Willems is on now. I'm Sarah Kanoski, you're with Books and Arts on RN. Get when you cross electronics with visual art? Well, in the case of Jeffrey Drake Brockman, you get solar dancing ballerinas, blooming origami flowers, and giant people counting machines. He's a Perth artist who uses robotics to create spectacular pieces of public art, which respond to and interact with their viewers. His work is now on show at the Linton and Kay Gallery in Perth, and Claire Nichols takes us there.
So it was about 5 years ago that I went to Sculpture by the Sea down at Cottesloe Beach, and there was one sculpture there which really captured my imagination. It was this giant yellow archway with a screen across the top with numbers on it, and when you walked through this archway, the number would tick over and add another person has walked through. It's a kind of simple idea, but there was something in it which was so joyful for me. I had so much fun. So I'm very excited to meet the creator of Counter and Everything in this exhibition, Jeffrey Drake Brockman. Jeffrey, that was a kind of layman's description of what that was, but can you explain to me the concept behind Counter?
This version of Counter in this exhibition, I call it Counter 2 because it's a reincarnation, if you like. It's got the same brain as the original Counter that you saw on the beach, but the outside of it is new. The original version of Counter was first commissioned by the City of Perth for a 3-week installation, but it lasted 9 years and it went around the world and counted more than a million people. I like to tell people that they have a choice of whether to be counted or not to be counted. And some people deliberately choose to avoid being enumerated as such because there's two aspects to receiving your number. There's the positive aspect to stand up and be counted, you know, to participate in the way that being counted implies. But there's also the disquieting idea of becoming just a number and being demoted, you know, to a series of digits.
In my case, I became several numbers because I ran through this thing so many times. Then I was trying to cheat the system. I'd try to sneak through and see if I couldn't be caught in the sensor. Then I'd go through with a friend and we'd try to see if maybe we could get two of us through without the number going off. What did you notice about the way people played with this sculpture?
My two favourite interactions that I observe when counters exhibited in the public, one thing I call a pedestrian vortex, where a group of people make a loop, continuously filing through counter over and over again. I love it when I see them, and they seem to self-organise every time I exhibit this particular work. And sometimes the motivation for them forming is because people get excited when a big number comes up, like a power of 10, 10,000 or 100,000. They want to clock it over. And sometimes a cry of applause goes out over the audience when it gets finally to 10,000. It's very exciting for me.
You've got a smaller version, as you said here. We've got the counter itself without the archway, but we still have a sensor. Can we try to set it off?
We can. We can walk past it.
Okay, let's see if we can do this. That click is so satisfying, and we're now up to 672. So you've had 672 people come through the exhibition so far, maybe.
Yes, so far. The fun part about counter are the electromechanical digits. They actually have pieces of metal that swing across and make that distinctive thwack sound each time a digit changes. And that's a big part of the fun of it.
A lot of your work obviously has this machine element and this beautiful visual art element. How did you come to be a man who works in robotics and visual art?
My original training, my first university degree, is actually in computer science. So I have a technical background, although I did later go to art school and study fine art. So the technical aspect has always been there. At first, I didn't use it. I chose just to paint with oil paint for many years. And then gradually, after going to art school, I changed my mind to incorporate concepts from technology and then later the actual mechanisms from technology into the work.
I imagine it's a huge amount of time and creativity to come up with these concepts and then actually make them work.
I try and make it look simple, but there's always complexity under the covers. But as long as it simply works and people can engage with its outer interaction, you don't need to know about the complexity. That's my problem.
Geoffrey, can we go have a look at Jane? Geoffrey, perhaps you can introduce me to Jane here.
Jane Smulders is the fabulous prima ballerina of the West Australian Ballet. And I've been working with Jane for many years. I was introduced to her as a possible model and assistant with a project I was contemplating at the time called the Coppelia Project, which is dealing with the idea that somebody can be a person or a robot or interchangeably both. Jane was familiar with the Coppelia Ballet and was very happy to help out. And as it turns out, that project has spawned a sequence of other artworks over the years, some of which are included in this exhibition.
So I know you've made some robotic ballerinas that can do moves. When I arrived, I walked past the amazing Solar Jane, which is almost looks like a life-sized inside of a jewellery box when that ballerina pops up and starts to rotate. Here we've got a little bust of Jane, and this is based on the face and body of Jane Smulders from the WA Ballet?
That's correct, yes. The work downstairs, Solar Jane, can pirouette, and her neck is also articulated. So when she spins around, she spots. That is, she focuses on the same point in space as she pirouettes. It's a very distinctive ballerina movement.
Where did this interest in ballet dancers come from for you?
I'm interested in stories about the nexus between people and who are natural beings and artificial beings. And there are a few fabulous stories about that. Pinocchio is one, the wooden boy who wishes he was real. But another story at the same calibre is the story of Coppelia, about a mechanical doll who's mistaken for a real girl And then a complex love triangle develops around this premise. And I thought it was a great story in which to sort of take the audience through the implications of technology converging with humanity.
This seems an appropriate time to go and have a look at a work over in the corner I can see. Can we head over this way? This piece, Jeffrey, has no moving parts. It almost seems like an anticlimax after going past the counter that many times, but it's very interesting work for you because it's a painting of Maria from Metropolis, which again fits into this machine-human thing that you've got going on.
Yeah, the work does indeed, and strangely enough, this is the oldest work in the exhibition. It's 19 years old, or 19 years since it was last exhibited. It may be 20 years old itself. And as you say, it's called Maria, and it's based on Fritz Lang's film masterpiece, Metropolis, the central character of which goes through a transition where at one moment she's a flesh and blood human, at another moment an automaton. And the whole premise of the story revolves around that change and the political repercussions of that transition. So she was an obvious departure point for one of my works.
I'm getting a bit of a creepy impression of what your studio space must look like with limbs and robotic things around it.
Yeah, it has that Dollmaker's kind of nightmare studio effect sometimes. I enjoy it, yes.
And that's funny because looking around this exhibition and your other works, there's so much colour. We're talking really vivid, bright pinks and greens and oranges. So you've got that dark aspect and that weird, you know, the dolls and all that. But obviously you've got a positive, bright outlook about things, Jeffrey.
Well, I do enjoy the idea of gothic horror, you know, those wonderful stories of Frankenstein and Dracula, and they inhabit my work at some level, even though everything is displayed in candy colours.
This is just suck us in, isn't it?
Perhaps that's right.
The artist Jeffrey Drake Brockman speaking to Claire Nichols in Perth, and you can see his exhibition Looking Glass at the Linton and Kay Gallery in Perth until May the 22nd. Stay with Books and Arts for Australia's latest, if most reluctant, literary star. Dodge Rose is a startling first novel from a young Sydney writer named Jack Cox. There's a real buzz around this book. It's a strange book. It's written in a modernist style that you might associate with James Joyce or maybe Samuel Beckett, to whom Jack Cox has been compared. And you have to really attend closely as a reader to know who's speaking and what's happening. My colleague Michael Cathcart rose to the challenge of reading Dodge Rose, and he thinks it really paid off. He describes it as a dreamlike experience where the reader is taken beneath the appearance of things. This week, Michael spoke with Jack Cox about his novel Dodge Rose.
The novel's first half is set in 1982. Eliza has arrived in Sydney to finalise the estate of her aunt Dodge, who has died. Well, obviously she's died. And she meets up there with Maxine, who has lived with Dodge for years as Dodge's adopted daughter. And so Maxine believes, with very good reason, that she will inherit some of the estate. But she soon discovers that nothing is clear, not even her own identity. Now, Jack, I'd love you to give the audience a sense of how beautiful your reading is, how rich and strange, as Shakespeare says in The Tempest, how rich and strange this world is you take us to. There's a little reference to radio, which I thought would be a nice link, a nice way in. Who's speaking here as the reading begins?
Maxine, and she's speaking about her time with Dodge in the flat in King's Cross.
All right, just take it away.
When the radio broke, our grave was really dug. All day Dodge listened to ABC Classic FM, the melodic fog rolling first thing over the living room. I would leave her for school standing by the window in a slate-coloured skirt, maybe, and a pinstripe blouse, swirling the insides of her cup to some semi-heard fugue. At times she would say, as if out of nowhere, "Ah, Sibelius, and with an effort I would recover a noise passed almost out of my perception, like surf or the rumble of traffic in the street below. Over dinner, the radio was retuned and Dodge chewed vacantly through the news, but I had been waiting all afternoon for that static fissure and the piping voice come sudden as a bat got in the window that flaps around the room trying to recover the open air. Not a batter what's at the other. I came back from school one day to dead silence. The radio was broken, she said, from the sofa where she appeared to have been watching herself in the reflection of her shoes. She must have sensed my disappointment in the evenings because she came up with an incentive for return. She bought poppy seed cakes by some kind of correspondence, and we had afternoon tea. She would pick an album to browse, and if she'd left a turd, she would be tender, though I would know then there is a turd. What happened to the piano, I asked one afternoon, my eyes having fallen on the angle of unfaded wallpaper underlapping the bookcase. Fell to pieces, said Dodge. That's impossible, I said. Ah, she breathed, and her eyes widened. That's right, Mother smashed it up. What for? Well, her voice trailed, she was very upset. Perhaps because the pilot died, beaten by his vans over the sea. She was a passionate woman, my mother, a bitter fit. Did you learn to play, I asked. Dodge looked surprised and raised her hands. She twiddled them over the air. Well, yes, I was very good. I'm sorry I can't play for you. Might have been your schoolmistress. It is a pity about the radio. I ought to buy a new one. She didn't, and a pall of silence settled down beneath the chatter. Silence settled down like dust.
Jack Cox, and his novel is called Dodge Rose. It's published in Australia by Text and in the USA by Dalkey Archive Press. Well, our regular book critic, Ronnie Scott, has been reading Dodge Rose, and he joins us now in our studio to discuss it. Good morning.
Hey, Michael.
Now, it's pretty obvious. I think it's terrific. Are you on the same line as me? Do you think it's good?
Yes, it's such a good book. It's a really, really good book, and it was so interesting to hear Jack Cox talk about it so intelligently as well.
It was interesting to hear him read then, because when he read it, it didn't seem so mysterious, did it? When on the page, you do spend, well, I don't know, the first 20 pages thinking, what on earth is this? How do I decode the fact that there is no typographic help?
Yeah, for sure. And by typographic help, that's things like what sometimes grammar, sometimes punctuation, sometimes things like capitalization, right? Which kind of changes as the book goes on.
Or he said, she said. He phases those out, actually, as the book goes on. Once you get your ear in, he stops telling you who's talking. You just have to get it.
Yeah, he kind of teaches you how to read it as it goes along. You know, it does kind of start in this difficult way, but it becomes more difficult. But at the same time, you become kind of more used to the rhythms of it. And what I found really interesting about hearing him read it was, as you say, it does just sound really kind of musical and rhythmic. And on the page, it is a totally different experience. But I found that you sort of get into the groove.
Yeah, I do too. So Maxine, this girl who thinks she's going to inherit the flat, isn't your typical narrator. I mean, it took me a while to work out that she was the narrator.
Yeah, it's in the first person, but it's a very sort of broad kind of first person style. So Max sometimes speaks as though she has access to other people's thoughts, including Eliza's, this other girl who's dealing with Dodge Rose's estate, and sometimes uses anachronistic language and things like that. Yeah. But I thought that was done in a way that was really kind of fluid and flexible at the same time. And eventually you just get a sense of the author's voice as well as Max's.
So we could talk a lot about the form, I guess, but it is amounting some kind of thesis. Mm. He is making an argument, I think, that's about the way in which the dispossession of these two girls mirrors the dispossession of Aboriginal Australians. So he's got this discourse about the evolution of land law in 19th century Sydney, a kind of essay about legal history. Did you go with that parallel?
Yeah, I did. But what I really like about it is that there's no kind of paragraph, right? You know, there's no bit of dialogue where someone says, hey, this is exactly like something that's happened long ago. It's more like it's mirrored in the language and the structure, which I felt was very clever.
Yeah. See, to me, that's the question about the book. Has he pulled this off or not? Is the parallel really there? Or are these two disparate ideas he hasn't quite yoked together? And I guess each reader will have their own feeling. But you felt that they were resonating nicely with each other, did you?
Yeah, but I also thought that as I was going along through the book, it's not like I had that. It's not like I was actively thinking about all this stuff. I was kind of more thinking about, as you say, this very sort of forthright form and language, as well as just what's happening with the plot. And maybe it was only days later that I kind of thought about how it resonated and how these things kind of belong together.
But isn't that interesting that days later you're thinking about a book, because we are professional readers. And really, you know, things don't come back to you days later when you're a professional reader, because you're engaging with the next thing.
Yeah, you forget about it the second you turn the final page, even if you love the book.
Yeah.
But yeah, I, one thing that I've really enjoyed about this book is that already, and I know that it was published in the US a while before it was published here, but so many people have written interesting blog posts and reviews where they've kind of been you know, digging out different parts of the book.
Yeah.
Well, and that's been fun to watch.
It was published in the US because Jack sent his manuscript to the American publisher Dalkey Archive Press, who have a reputation for publishing experimental, slightly offbeat stuff. And it ended up on the desk of the company's then senior editor, Jeremy M. Davies. And I spoke to Jeremy last week, and here's what he had to say about the manuscript when it first arrived.
Well, it landed really out of nowhere. I had no idea who the author was. I didn't recognize his name. He was basically invisible on the internet. Yeah, I couldn't find any other publications. And it came in on paper, which was increasingly rare. So I really had absolutely no basis for reading the book as anything but, you know, an over-the-transom manuscript, most of which are discarded very soon after they arrived. And I immediately was struck that this was something very different.
You say, though, that you feared it might be a hoax.
Yes, I did. That was my first thought. I took it around to my assistant editor at the time, and we both had an ongoing conversation over several weeks. Mr. Cox could obviously write very, very well, but was also taking a lot of very strange chances, you know, deforming the language in a lot of peculiar ways, using very strange punctuation. It made me think of the Ern Mali hoax, famously. It made me think maybe, you know, someone like Peter Carey was having us on.
So why would you be targeted for a hoax? Is it because Dalkey is a small press which specializes in experimental and subversive fiction? Did you think that you might be in the firing line for someone who thought that the sort of work you produced needed to be exposed? Is that the idea?
Yeah, exactly. Like this concept that, you know, the emperor has no clothes, you know, that people can't read the book, they don't know what it means, and there's just sort of a conspiracy of academics who are going about saying that this is a brilliant work to keep themselves in the clover, as it were, and there's no actual literature there, etc. And I, you know, certainly don't believe that, and I certainly don't believe that of Mr. Cox, because I think it's a brilliant book. But the reason I thought it was a hoax, largely, I suppose, was that it seemed too good to just appear like that.
Yes.
And I was doubting my own taste, which I think often happens with difficult literature. You sort of doubt what is it that you're seeing in the work, because it's very difficult to summarize or explain to someone else. And it just was so controlled. You know, it reminded me of Samuel Beckett as well. It seemed to have a real preternatural understanding of the language, even as it took so many liberties with, you know, normal usage.
So as we wind up, Jeremy, how big a claim do you want to make for this book? How good do you think it is in the scale of literary achievement?
A pretty big one, you know? I mean, I wouldn't say it is the Ulysses of Australian literature. I think there's actually some other books that probably would have to come first than that. But it's a pretty remarkable debut novel. It may be one of the most remarkable debut novels to ever go out there, and I think it's going to live on.
Jeremy Davis, a former editor with US Dalkey Archive Press, who've published Dodge Rose by the Australian writer Jack Cox, who's been compared to James Joyce and Samuel Beckett. Now, if that's not pressure, I don't know what is. Michael Cathcart was speaking with Jeremy Davies and with Jack Cox, alongside our regular book reviewer, Ronnie Scott. And if you'd like to know more about Dodge Rose and Jack Cox, have a look at the feature article on the Books and Arts website. This coming week, it's the Sydney Writers' Festival, and of course, Books and Arts are going to be there. Michael Cathcart will be bringing you the show live on Friday from the Sydney Writers' Festival, and there'll be a bunch of other panels and interviews that we'll be doing next week and bringing you over the coming weeks at Books and Arts. Make sure you hear Michael's interview with Julian Barnes this Thursday on the show. There'll be lots of great book stuff wherever you're listening around Australia. I'm Sarah Kanoski. I'll catch you next Saturday, or I'll see you at the Writers' Festival.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.